I thought immovable object is probably very breakable. You make an object immovable for an hour. Great. I'm about to get swallowed every single time that I can.
Right. I will rip through you on the inside, sir. Live from the Mundangerous Horizon Back Tortoise in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Yishin.
And welcome to episode 243 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're reviewing the newest release for 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons, The Explorer's Guide to Wildemount. We'll walk you through it cover to cover and let you know whether it's worth adding to your collection.
Total Party Thrill is brought to you this week by D&D Beyond. D&D Beyond is the official digital toolset and game companion for Dungeons & Dragons.
You can use it to build characters, track campaigns, run adventures, and do so much more. Like, for example, Shane, how are you reading the Wildemount book?
I am reading it on D&D Beyond because we are social distancing due to COVID-19. You got the copy of the book, and I am improvising.
Even had I gotten two copies of the book, I'm not sure how I would have gotten it to you.
I would still be improvising.
Fortunately, it's all there. Even the art is there.
The art's there. It's very convenient. It has links out to all the maps and things like that. So I was able to quickly look through all the important visuals. Takes you through table of contents. It's great. It's a great way. I was a traditionalist. Just give me the PDF. But having read the book this way, I actually like it a lot.
Yeah, every time there's something, a phrase or a reference that you don't understand or you don't remember off the top of your head, you just hover over it and a little pop-up shows up, or you click through and now you know exactly what you're talking about.
It's the best way to look through a spell list. We'll get into the Dunamancy spells, but you just hover over them, it tells you exactly what they are. It's great.
All right, there's lots of other awesome content for free, like the D&D Basic Rules and articles from writers like James J. Heck and videos from people like Todd Kenrick.
So the D&D Beyond team is always updating the site with new features and improvements, so check back soon.
All right, so this week there is no Gates of Morning campaign recap, and there is no Character Creation Forge because we are spending the entire episode on this new book, The Explorer's Guide to Wildemount, which is the fourth campaign setting book from Wizards of the Coast for Dungeons & Dragons, 5th edition, after Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide, which was in Forgotten Realms, Guildmaster's Guide to Ravnica, which was a Magic the Gathering setting, and of course our favorite, Eberron, Rising from the Last War.
I see Acquisitions Inc. gets no love from Ishin.
Does that count as a setting?
I mean, if Sword Coast does, so does Acquisitions Inc., right? Even if they are in the same place.
We didn't actually review that book, did we? Is that the only one we didn't review?
Yeah, technically. We talked about it. It's fine.
All right, so this is also the first 5th edition book from Wizards of the Coast set in Exandria, which is the world from Critical Role, Matthew Mercer's long-running streaming D&D game. Now, back in 2017, Green Ronin published a setting book for Tal'Darai, one of the continents of Exandria, for use with 5th edition. This is the first one officially from Wizards of the Coast, and it focuses on Wildemount, which is another continent, where apparently the second campaign of Critical Role takes place.
That was spoken like two true Critical Role fans who did not read it off of Wikipedia.
Not in any way. Speaking of which, Shane, what is your history with Critical Role?
None. Not entirely. I suppose I did watch, there was one series probably in the lead up to one of the earlier adventures, Storm King's Thunder. There was something like the Grey Knights or some subgroup that was led by Matt Mercer. I don't know. I don't think that actually fit into Critical Role, but I watched that. Yeah, it gave me a sense for the style anyway.
Yeah, I have seen zero episodes of Critical Role. We are familiar with Matt Mercer. We are familiar with the Blood Hunter, perhaps notoriously so.
And hey, we think Matt Mercer's a nice guy, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, actually.
Nothing against him. We just, don't watch a lot of video actual play, and you barely pay attention to any actual play at all.
It's true. It's true. Do people play online games and stream them for other people? Is that a thing that people do?
That's a thing that people do.
But we are aware of Critical Role and the fact that it's basically a phenomenon. I'm pretty sure it is solely responsible for, maybe half the people who play 5e D&D these days.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is I think that's underselling even its like impact on D&D 5th edition, right? Like, I think it has influenced, brought a ton of people to the game, as well as influenced the style of game that lots of people are running, even if they played D&D before Critical Role.
Right. And so let's make it clear. Mercer has said very specifically that he wants this to be a book that you can pick up even if you know nothing about Critical Role and still play in a new setting. But if you do really like Critical Role, then it should be something that has a lot of like Easter eggs or recognizable things that should make it enjoyable for you. I will say very specifically, though, so Matt Mercer is the lead writer on this particular book, but you can see that a lot of the design chops are being handled by James J. Heck, James Intricasso, and Chris Lockie. And Ed Mercer has been very clear that like he doesn't necessarily consider himself like a designer first and foremost. He is a writer and a world builder.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of the book itself, it is nearly as big as the Eberron book. It's 304 pages and includes a full color folded map of the continent of Wildmount.
So let's start off with the cover. There is no limited edition cover for this book. So it's just that like high gloss, full color look. It's like a 4E style, I guess I would call it, detailed illustration that shows basically busts of two of the important NPCs from Wildmount. And in the middle of them is a Luxon beacon, which is one of the MacGuffin magic items from the setting.
This is in the style of like the Critical Role sort of cartoon/comic book fan art style, which we'll see kind of further on in the book as well.
Yeah, the dude on the left, did you know that's a human? I totally thought it was a dwarf or like a Dwergar.
I did not think it was a dwarf. I thought it was some type of evil elf.
Okay. Nope, human.
Okay. All right. I see you.
All right. So we start off with Welcome to Wildmount. This is a brief overview of the major powers on the continent, and it lets you know that, you know, in the current continuity, there was a war happening between two of these major powers, but you can set your campaign either in the middle of this war or right before the war between the Dwendalian Empire and the Kryn Dynasty. All the information in the book is current as of Critical Role episode 50 in campaign 2, which I guess means a thing.
Yeah, that sounds important to somebody who really cares about that. Right. For me, I like that there is a big world-shaking event setting the backdrop that gives you the freedom to improvise and fit your campaign into it.
Right. And then we get just a little information about the calendar, the climate of different areas of the continent, and the different languages that you might be able to pick up.
Yeah, this is similar to the Order of the Eberron rising from the last war, right?
Right.
Like, give you that high-level overview stuff you might reference once, or you might skip over the first time and then reference back to if you ever need it.
Right. Or 3 months into your campaign, you go, wait, what month is it?
Yeah.
Or what languages can I pick up?
Right.
All right. Chapter one is the story of Wildmount, and it opens up with the creation myth of the entire world. So not just this one particular continent, but the entire planet of Exandria, which I guess includes Tal Dorei.
Sure.
So it's pretty traditional. I think we'll see this throughout this entire book. It's pretty like traditional high fantasy. It's a lot like Forgotten Realms and sort of with a more modern reskinning.
Right.
So there was a war between the gods and the primordials. The betrayer gods sided with the primordials and they lost and they were locked away. And then mortals discovered arcane magic and there was another war between the gods and the betrayer gods and that destroyed most of the world. And then to save the world, the gods sort of took all the betrayer gods and dragged them away from the world and locked themselves behind the divine gate. And now all the gods and the evil gods are very distant.
That sounds like exactly where I want the gods to be in my fantasy setting.
Yes, exactly. Well, you don't love the Time of Troubles?
Yeah,
Garl,
exactly.
Glitter gold just walking around.
This is cool. Then it gets into the history of the major regions. So you have the Dwendalian Empire, who are isolationist and warlike. You have the Menagerie Coast, After My Own Heart. These are the pirates of the setting.
Oh, it's totally just the Lazar Principalities. Absolutely.
Right. Yeah, because it's the raddest part of Eberron. Why
right.
wouldn't you steal that?
To the north are the graying wildlands, which are being corrupted by some kind of malign influence. And then you have the Kryn Dynasty, which is ruled by surface-dwelling drow who worship an enigmatic entity they call the Luxon, which appears, a piece of it appears on the cover.
So there is its own pantheon set up here. It is very similar to 4th edition when Critical Role began. So when you look at the list of and the list of the names of the gods and sort of their domains, like you go, oh, that's Forgotten Realms. I get it. That's cool.
Yeah, or Points of Light or Greyhawk thrown in or whatever, right? So like Arathis is here, the goddess of civilization. The Raven Queen shows up, who is the coolest god introduced in 4th edition.
And then you have the evil deities, you know, the traditional, you know, your Grumshes and your Tiamats. They're the betrayer gods.
You got your Lolth over here. You got your Tharizdun. You know, the ones you would expect are the betrayers. And then you've got a bunch of, like, lower level, what might have been called lesser deities previously. And that's it. Chapter 2 is factions and society. And you've got details on each of the major powers, not just nations, but organizations as well. Their goals, who rules them, what laws are in place in particular countries, what relationships do these countries have to other nations? You know, what does the Dwendalian Empire think about the Kryn Dynasty? They hate each other.
Yeah, spoiler.
What do people in the Menagerie Coast think about the war? I don't want to get involved in that. I would prefer to just be a pirate. And this is, I believe, the first time that we begin getting in an official Wizards of the Coast book non-binary and gender fluid NPCs who are officially called out as just non-binary or gender fluid in the space in their write-up where you would normally list male or female.
Right.
There are organizations like the Clovis Concord, which is a trading power, like a mercantile organization. And then the Myriad, or I guess just Myriad, which is a massive crime syndicate.
Yeah, I like anytime you have massive crime empire just quietly running things below the surface. You also get into like different religious orders.
Yeah, you get your cults and your enigmatic do-gooder religious orders, your version of the Harpers, basically.
Right. You know, you get the tribal families of Shady Creek Run and, you know, all the different kind of things you need in any given area on the map. They all pretty much track kind of one-to-one.
Yeah, the organizations that you might want your character to have ties to make them feel like part of a lived world.
Right.
And then Chapter 3, which is a third of the entire book, the Wildemount Gazetteer. It is a 102-page atlas of locations across the continent. You'll recognize this from pretty much every other setting book. It lists the country or the area and then tells you its population and then its government and lists some notable locations that people might be visiting or might be from. One thing I do like about this, though, is each section also includes at least one, but usually more adventure hooks, like a thing that might be happening here or something that the GM can use to pull people in. Although that does make this section a little bit more GME or GM focused. So, you know, if you have players sort of leafing through it to see where they might actually want to be from, you're sort of spoiling all those hooks.
That's true, which is a little difficult because you don't have a section that you can really hand off to the players here. But I do like the way they present those hooks, namely that they kind of group them by like low level, mid level, high level, epic level, where you can kind of get a sense of how much influence is this plot hook going to have on the world around you, right? Like, how high level are the players involved in this type of thing, and therefore, what level should the characters be?
Yeah, and this is where D&D Beyond really shines. You look at some of these hooks, and, oh, there are vine blights around. Great, what's a vine blight? I'll just hover.
Hover.
Right? And these sections do have a lot of background info about life in Wildemount. So if you do decide where you're going to be from, or later in the book, we'll see ways that you can pick a place that you're from without necessarily just leafing through this section. You can just point somebody directly to that section and say, hey, just read the beginning of it. And when you get to adventure hooks, stop.
Right. Yeah, this part is, I will say, a little bit dense because it's broken into like the eight sort of, I don't know, country level areas on the map, but then each of those is kind of broken into, you know, 6 to 15 like areas on that section of the map as well. Keeping track of like the distinction between, you know, the Amber Crossroads in the Zemni Fields versus the Boroftkra in the Graying Wildlands is like, oh boy, like it's a lot to bring in for a first read. But it's one of those things where if you're setting your adventure starting in the Graying Wildlands, if you have that sense, like cool, now you've got what you need in one place.
Right. Like, this is definitely not probably a book where you sit down and read it cover to cover, especially this section.
Unless you're reviewing it.
Right. Woohoo! It's definitely a reference material where you already know what you need to be doing, or your players have told you what area they want to be in, or you know that, you know, they're moving west to solve this quest, and so they're going to be moving into this other country. Let me see what they're going to come up against.
Right.
Or what information can the party discover from research checks? And then sprinkled throughout in places next to the regions where you might find these things, there are a lot of sidebars on things like how to buy a skyship, or what kind of special herbs you might find in a place, or what is the name of the local militia in this particular town.
Yeah. What did you think of the art in this section?
I think it's indicative of the art in most of the book. It's sort of all over the place. The styles are divergent. I mean, there's some that is very good. Most of this is like half page art. Some of it, I think, is recycled from previous editions or books or reskinned and, you know, given a different kind of name. It feels very traditional to me. It doesn't feel like the 4E version of the cover, like the kind of art from the cover. It feels much more like Forgotten Realms traditional high fantasy art. Like I recognize, oh, this scene in a bazaar. Could it be a scene in any bazaar?
Yeah. See, to me, like I'm curious because you're looking at the physical book. I'm looking at it online. Like there is a lot more places that seem to have kind of unique ideas to them than there are art for those places. So like as I go through, like I'm not getting an immediate like visceral reaction to a lot of the things that are in this section.
Right. In the book, there's probably a half page of art every 4 to 8 pages. So, I mean, definitely there's not a piece of art for each particular region.
Yeah.
There are some nice maps scattered throughout, and it is nice that there in the table of contents, it lists out the different maps.
All right, so then what we're really here for, always, chapter 4, character options.
Yeah, I mean, this might be the reason that you get the book in the first place or buy it on D&D Beyond, just so you have access to additional character options. So in a Wild Mount campaign, you can choose from many different uncommon races, like Aarakocra, Firbolg, Asimar, Genasi, Tortles are in here. And every single one of these races that is not in the player's handbook is reprinted here. So actually, that does take up a lot of space. I mean, it's nice that you have them here and they aren't just called out as races that are common all over the place in Wild Mount. But, you know, if you want to have access to them, you've got to go buy like the Chult book.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't realize that was like fully reprinted in the book. I thought that was a convenience of D&D Beyond.
No, yeah, every single one is printed out in full here. All 3 Asimar subraces, all 4 Genasi subraces.
But there are some new things in here too.
Absolutely. So you get cultural descriptions for each of the PHB races. You know, how do dwarves fit in Wild Mounts, elves, and things like that. But we also get 2 new elf subraces.
Yep, there is the Pallid Elf.
So Pallid Elves feel to me like the Wild Mount answer to the Mark of Detection Half-Elves from Eberron, in that these are elves who get +1 to wisdom, advantage on insight and investigation. They're very perceptive elves, even more than average elves. And then they have the like cantrip, first level spell, second level spell, feature that like tieflings get, except they can cast light as a cantrip, and eventually they can cast sleep and invisibility once per day.
Then you have the sea elves, who are sea bound or sea dwelling elves, right? They're on the shore, territorial. They're kind of merfolk or other intelligent sea dwelling folk. They are sort of the outcasts of the elves, right? They see themselves as sort of like more territorial, more isolated. But they get a bonus to constitution. They get a swim speed and the ability to breathe air and water. They get a couple of the like underwater useful proficiencies, spear, trident, etc. And then their big thing is that they can communicate with beasts that have an innate swimming speed. That kind of gives them the one up on other aquatic races.
I like that we're getting another swimming race. Before this, it's what, Triton and maybe Lizard Folk, but I think Lizard Folk don't even breathe water, right? They just have a swim speed.
Right.
It's nice for pirate games if everybody chooses one of these. And it means you don't have to do the whole half-elf thing where you give up those skill proficiencies in order to pick up the swim speed because you're like a half-sea elf.
Right.
Halflings also get one sub-race. The Lotus Den Halflings, who are basically druid halflings. They get plus one to wisdom, they can cast druid craft, and then entangle and spike growth once per day, and they ignore difficult terrain made of plants, and their creatures have disadvantage to track them. That last one feels like it's just kind of useless on certain kinds of druids, so you are sort of, I guess, meant to be a druid, and yet...
yeah, and yet you've doubled down into what it is, right?
Right.
I mean, the fact that there's more races with a wisdom bonus, even if they're all plus one, is kind of helpful because, boy, you know, nature clerics, monks, druids are hard up to find wisdom.
Yeah, I mean, the Firbolg is in here too, right? Plus two to wisdom.
Finally.
Right. It makes sense to me, like, the sort of the conceit of Wildemount is that the earth itself, like the land itself, kind of hates civilization and is actively trying to destroy it, whether that's because of the primordials or they're just like giant beasts roaming the land. So I think certainly nature clerics and druids and all those kinds of classes would probably be pretty common.
Yeah.
And then we get two dragonborn, not really sub-races, they're variants. So they replace the ability score increase bonuses and the damage resistance traits from the player's handbook version of the dragonborn. First up is the Drakenblood. You get plus two to intelligence and increase charisma by one. You have dark vision, which is great because normally dragonborn don't get dark vision. And then forceful presence once per short rest. You can give yourself advantage on an intimidation or persuasion check. And then there are the grunt version, the soldier version, the Ravenite Dragonborn, who instead get plus two to strength and plus one to con, dark vision, and you can use a reaction to make an attack against a creature that has just damaged you once per short rest.
You also get, notably, orcs and half-orcs, both separately, and the orc version is the one from Eberron.
Right, so you're not getting massive penalties to, what is it, intelligence and charisma? You could just be a normal orc who doesn't suck.
Yeah, exactly.
And then we get, I guess it's a race called Hollow One. These are people who have died. And I think their soul has moved on, but their body has kind of been reanimated by some unknown force. And they still have the memories of their old life. So to them, it feels like they just came back to life. Mechanically, it is a supernatural gift. As one of the ones listed in the Dungeon Master's Guide. So it's just put on top of a different race, and it just gives you benefits. You don't age ever, so you will never die of old age. On a death save of 16 plus rather than just 20, you regain 1 HP and become conscious again. You count as undead. I guess maybe that might be a drawback in some instances. And then once per day, you can use an action to cause disadvantage on a creature's next saving throw, and they don't get a save to resist this. You just basically point at a creature and say, you get disadvantage on your next save.
That is actually super powerful.
Yeah.
Like, that's cool. And because this just adds on to your existing race, you know, because it's all just additive, you don't lose what made your character work when the GM decides to keep you around in the game, right?
Right. How do you feel about this mechanically? Like, I like it in terms of story because often you get in those situations where, you know, someone's character died and maybe it didn't quite work for the story, or, you know, you want them to be able to continue adventuring with the party. So now you can make them a hollow one and they have come back for some other purpose. And now you're tying that even deeper into the story. But I can see a lot of, you know, power gaming players being like, I want to be a half elf. Also a hollow one.
Yeah, I wouldn't let people start with this, but I think my guess is that this has come into play on the show, and this is the representation of that now in the rules so that other DMs can introduce the concept as well. And from a storytelling and, like, I'm running an actual play show, this makes a lot of sense, right? Because you have beloved characters that need to fundamentally change now that they have died. You can't undo that, but you still want that character continuing on their story. It does really limit the value of killing characters in your story. because if you undo one, everyone is going to kind of start to expect that, right?
Yeah. It's called in the text that hollow ones occur much more commonly in, I think it's the Blight Shore, which I guess can make sense if people know that they're going to this sort of haunted part of the landscape for the whatever 3 to 5 levels that you might spend there, or that particular campaign arc. Maybe like it is, hey, if you die, you might come back as a hollow one. Once you leave, okay, you're continuing the quest, but you're not going to be reanimated anymore, or can the hollow one even follow after, or whatever, right?
Yeah.
I guess when you're doing a live stream, also like a show, you also have an actor who doesn't want to be like out of a job or not on the show anymore because their character died.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it's a practical concern. Like, you know, you lose your character and like all of a sudden your B star is off. Mm-hmm. Like I get it. You know, you don't kick a player out and you don't necessarily want to have to weave in a new character into your ongoing arc. So it's a useful tool. I just, you know, it's kind of a use in a limited fashion kind of thing for me.
Yeah, I agree. I like that this option now exists. And I think that if someone is playing a hollow one, you should make the fact that they count as undead be meaningful. Like, people can turn them. There are lots and lots of class features and abilities and spells that either don't work on undead or work differently on dead or only work on undead. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah. All right, then there are some new subclasses, 3 of them.
All of these subclasses use Dunamancy. They don't all necessarily cast spells, but they all use this school of magic that, you know, manipulates fate and probability and timelines and like physics, weirdly. Like, this book actually calls out the word science. I think it's the first time I've seen that in a setting where like the people in the setting actually use the word science.
Yeah, it's sort of your like unified field theory of magic study, right? Where you're trying to tie those two things together. I don't know if it's Dunamancy or Dunamancy. I guess we're probably going to accidentally use both. But
I mean, at us, I guess, sure.
Yeah. It's in that weird space where it's kind of like it's luck and probability and a little bit of like foretelling and foresight, but then it's also just like gravity.
Yeah.
Which, yeah. I don't know. It's fine. It's sort of the underpinning theory of like, if physics underpins how matter interacts, it underpins how magic interacts.
Right. Like if you could apply the scientific method to how magic works in this particular setting, then these are the spells you get.
Right. Yeah. But it's supposed to be like sort of a very ancient study that is very, very limited. Most of the knowledge is lost. The Kryn dynasty are really the ones who still pursue it. You know, it's not meant to be like in Eberron, right, where artificing is sort of the scientific method applied to magic, mm-hmm. by everybody to give something of an industrial society. Like, this is meant to be a closely hoarded secret that produces like a new type of magic compared to Forgotten Realms or other settings.
I don't know why it's closely hoarded. The spells aren't particularly great, but you know, we'll get to that.
I don't know. Some of them are fun.
Some of them are fun, certainly, but they're not like particularly powerful.
Sure.
All right, so Fighter gets the Echo Knight subclass. This is a fighter who manipulates probabilities and potential alternate timelines. So your main ability is at level 3, you can manifest an echo of yourself. It's basically like a translucent shadow that you make as a bonus action. You can do it as often as you want, but you can only have one of these things. And as a bonus action, you can swap places with your echo. Or whenever you want, you can make one of your attacks from its space instead of from your space. However, kind of like a familiar, the Echo only has one... Well, the Echo has 1 HP, and its AC is 14 plus your proficiency bonus, and that is it. So it is very, very fragile. It's going to pop a lot.
Yeah, you're going to spend a lot of bonus actions just getting it back up.
Yeah.
which is fine. I mean, on the... You know, what you're really using it for is... at the same time, you get an additional attack from your Echo's space, con mod number of times per day. So obviously you're going to want to get your con up so you can take advantage of this, but this is a way to get like an extra great weapon attack, right? That just otherwise isn't possible really without being a frenzy barbarian.
Right. And this is on top of like your normal 3 and eventually 4 attacks as a fighter.
Right.
At level 7, you'll be able to use an action to see through your echo senses, just like you would be able to with a familiar. And when you're doing this, its range increases to 1,000 feet. So it's actually a pretty good scouting ability. Keep in mind, though, if you like start looking through your own eyes again, then it ends and then your echo immediately is destroyed. So once it goes further than 30 feet away from you, you've got to like keep this on until right. it comes back.
At 10th level, you can interpose your echo in front of an attack once per short rest. So it has to be within 5 feet of the thing that's attacking you. But, you know, it's a way to avoid the killing blow or something like that.
Yeah, I think, you know, initially I'm thinking, oh, maybe you could throw the echo in front of an attack and it, like it misses the echo, right? Because it could hit somebody, but then it targets the echo instead. But the echo's got pretty low AC to begin with, so almost always it's going to get hit by this. But one thing to consider, though, is if it is an attack that isn't dealing damage, the echo, I think, is immune to all conditions. So right. if this is something that is just dominating somebody, an attack that might dominate a lot of monsters, have things like that, you throw the echo in front of it, and even if it doesn't pop, you've saved someone from a very bad effect that isn't going to affect your echo at all.
Right.
At level 15, you regain a bit of temp HP when your echo is destroyed, although you can only do this con mod number of times per day. And then at 18, you can make two echoes at once, which is definitely a force multiplier. What do you think of this subclass?
I struggle on the power side of it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because in general, like as a fighter, your value is putting all of your attacks into one target and using that to get your damage up over the course of the turn. It doesn't do enough defensively to like make me think it makes you a hugely better tank. So it's a little difficult for me. It's kind of like the same boat as the Ranger subclass that like gets a bonus when you attack different targets. It's like, cool, that doesn't really work us towards our objective, though.
Right, the Horizon Walker. Yeah, I agree. I think the one thing that's maybe interesting is this isn't technically magic, so you could do this while you were a barbarian who was raging, which is fine, but compare this to like having Battlemaster maneuvers, and I would much rather have maneuvers.
Yeah, there's it. I mean, that's the problem, is that Battlemaster Fighter really stands out and still holds up.
All right, and then we get two wizard traditions. The first one is Chronergy, which I guess you can tell has to do with time and probability.
Mm-hmm.
I like this one. So at level 2, twice per day, you can force a reroll of a d20. It can be one that you made, or it can be one that you see being made that another creature is rolling. This is not quite as good as the Divination Wizard's Portent, but it's still quite good.
Yeah, it's sort of it's between lucky and portent for me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then you also get intelligence modifier to initiative, which is great because controllers always want to go as early as possible. At level 6, you can force a constitution saving throw, or a creature becomes incapacitated and its speed drops to 0. And you can do this intelligence modifier number of times per day.
This is the poor man's hold person, right?
Yeah, exactly. Or a poor man's hypnotic pattern. I like that it doesn't use a spell slot, but you're still limited in number of uses per day, and it's single target.
Yeah, but it's intelligence modifier, so you're going to get 3 to 6 uses of it.
Yeah, I think of it as like, okay, we're facing a huge solo monster. I can lock them down for one round, and everybody can gather around and just smack it for free. That's great. It's too bad it's a con save, because those giant monsters almost always have excellent con saves.
It's also a really good way to force out legendary saves.
Yeah, that's true.
So this one I actually like.
At level 10, once per short rest, you can put a 4th level spell or lower into a bead and hand it to anybody, and they can use it, and that lasts for an hour. This is a great ability. Like, there's no limit on the number of times you can do this. You just need to take a short rest. So you can only have one at a time, right? Because it'll expire before you finish another short rest.
Right.
But it is great to be able to just like hand out a dispel magic or a high level like mass cure wounds to somebody who's not the healer.
Yeah. These are those things though where you give your cool thing to somebody else and like, what did I get for that? You know? It's certainly powerful, it's good for planning, but it's one of those things where like it's almost like a feels bad.
I like it as a sort of poor man's contingency.
Okay.
We're like, hey, I'm giving you this. If this thing happens in the next hour, throw it. Mm-hmm. Or it is an opportunity to double your action economy, right? So I cast a fireball into the bead, I hand it to you, and then I actually cast fireball, and I basically get to cast two fireballs at the same time.
Right. Or maintain two concentrations.
Actually, that's a great way to split up concentration. Right, yeah. I want to concentrate on two spells. I hand it to you, and you concentrate.
Yeah, it's great for the for like, I don't know, the rogue maybe, who you can confidently expect will avoid a lot of the damage.
Or the archer who's standing in back and doing nothing with their concentration.
Right.
And then this is interesting. At 14, you can take a level of exhaustion and force a roll that either you make or someone else makes. You just need to be able to see it. To either succeed or fail, your choice. And you can't remove the exhaustion except by taking a long rest, so there's no greater restoration shenanigans here.
Right.
This is high cost, high reward. I like this.
I also like the ability. I really hate the way it's worded.
Because it's like, yeah.
It talks about the die roll. And so you decide whether the die roll is the number, the minimum needed to succeed, or one less than that number. What does that do to modifiers? What does that do to other effects that interact with it? Like, the clear intent here is that it should supersede all of that, and it's either a choice of pass or fail, but why not just say that?
Right. There are a lot of other abilities in the game that just say, this now succeeds or this now fails.
Right.
There are a couple places where the wording is not great in this section. There are a couple places in here where the natural language philosophy of 5th edition really sort of fails. And you wish that it had just been standardized across abilities that do exactly the same thing.
Right.
All right, and then we have Graviturgy, which, of course, manipulates gravity, which is a word that is used. And that's a holdover, right? Reverse gravity is an old, old spell that's been along forever. It has always bothered me that it uses the word gravity.
Because gravity doesn't exist in a fantasy setting without the scientific method?
It certainly might not, right? Or why would you call it gravity?
Right. Okay, so at level 2, we will get Adjust Density, which as an action, you can adjust a creature's weight up or down, requires concentration, and then the effect of this is either they gain or lose 10 feet to their speed, and can like jump easier, things like that, in exchange for disadvantage on strength checks and strength saving throws, or they gain advantage on strength checks and strength saving throws.
I think this is a super cool ribbon ability. It is very underpowered for any wizard's level 2 ability.
It's an action and takes concentration.
Takes concentration.
Like a bonus action and concentration? I could live with it.
Yeah. I really like the idea that you're standing there with, you know, the fighter, and you're like, hey, I increase your density. You have advantage on strength checks. Now you can break open pretty much anything that we want you to anytime. Or the barbarian who doesn't need to use a rage in order to smash things anymore. And hey, we're gonna jump over this chasm. Great. I make everybody lighter one at a time and we'll go. We all go over. Cool.
Yeah.
But it's so limited in use.
I mean, to a degree, but it opens you up for some things, right? I need an extra 10 feet, or like I am the fighter who has the extra attack to spend so that I can do, you know, grappling or shoving, things like that, that are going to be force multipliers. I don't mind it as a bonus action. I just want to do something cool on my turn as well, like throw a freaking fireball.
Right. Costing an action means that it's not even really that great thrown on a grappler.
Right.
All right. At level 6, you can move a creature 5 feet when you hit it with a spell, or it doesn't save against one of your spells, or you cast it on a willing creature. I guess also, like, great. In 5th edition, there aren't a ton of things that really trigger off of forced movement. You know, this isn't 4th edition where, you know, it's really easy to move people into giant areas of effect. You can do that. It's just you would need to do a lot of setup in order to make sure that you have like your cloud kill down first.
This is going to be a theme here because at level 10, you get Violent Attraction, which just lets you use your reaction to either increase the damage done to a creature or increase the falling damage that they take. Basically, you accelerate the projectile that they use.
And those are already, I mean, the falling damage is already so limited in when you can actually trigger it, but it's also then limited to intelligence modifier number of times per day that you can use this ability at all.
Yeah, and you're a wizard. It costs you your reaction,
right,
which is valuable because of counterspell. So, or shield, right?
Well, let's keep going. At level 14, you can use an action to begin a repelling field, basically, that deals damage to all hostile creatures within 30 feet of you, and then reduces their speed to zero if they fail a strength saving throw. Even if they succeed on it, it takes them a lot more movement in order to move closer to you.
Yeah, it costs triple movement. Every 1 foot costs 2 extra feet.
Which is cool, but also, this costs your concentration too. You are right. A 14th level wizard. Your concentration is spoken for.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm making everything lighter. That's what I'm doing.
Right. but this gets into like kind of a weird thing that's here. Like Event Horizon and the Gravity Well and Adjust Density and the Echo Knight's like manipulation of space. Like all of this is very dependent on a grid. Because I just don't see these things being super useful in Theater of the Mind. I assume Critical Role is using Map and Minis. Again, haven't seen it, so don't know for sure. But maybe that makes sense for them. Like, a lot of these things are just not going to be easy to implement or useful to you if you're running Theater of the Mind.
Right. All right, so what do you think of these two wizard subclasses?
They're fine. Of the ones that I would play, I mean, I would probably play Chronergy. I think I would enjoy playing Graviturgy in a game that were like much more narrative D&D than necessarily like map and mini grid dungeon delvey D&D. But I don't think it's going to upset anybody's game to allow any of these classes in.
Yeah, I totally agree with that last part. I would be hard-pressed to want to play Graviturgy, although I can definitely see it as a dip. I would love on like a rogue or whatever character to take two levels of this and go around and just keep changing everything's gravity and density, you know, just because I can, because I'm not doing anything else with my concentration because I'm not a spellcaster, really.
Okay. Now I'm very interested in Graviturgy. I didn't think about this on a class that already doesn't concentrate.
and then Chronergy, I think it's actually a pretty good subclass. I would still take Divination Wizard over it, though.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Divination is just better.
Yeah. All right. Dunamancy spells. We have 10 new spells. However, they are only available for subclasses that are not in this book by DM fiat. You have to ask your GM if you can use them. I don't see a problem with just like adding these to the wizard spell list. I understand like you don't want every new spell to be a force multiplier for like wizards and sorcerers, but like the real limiting factor is spells known and then spell slots, really.
Yeah, the weird part of that like distinction to me is like not that power creep thing. It's just, they're already available to wizards who have every other spell list, so, or every other spell on the spell list. So, like, what are the subclass abilities for wizards that you're worried about these interacting with?
Right.
Because really, that's all you're restricting their reaction or their interaction to is just the subclass abilities, because the spells are all the same otherwise.
Right. And there's no spell in this book where I immediately want to switch out a spell that I already know for one of these. None of them are so amazingly powerful, but like you said before, some of them are very cool. They're cantrip up to 9th level, and they're pretty much all gravity or time themed. I thought Dark Star was cool. It's an 8th level, basically disintegration sphere.
Yeah, you say none of these that you would want, but Dark Star is on my list.
I mean, but it's 8th level, right? So it's competing with every other 8th level spell that I could take, and I could only cast one of those a day.
Yeah, but I hate 8th level spells, so
really,
this one is at least
fun. Really? You
don't
like Earthquake?
Fun. No. Earthquake sucks.
I love Earthquake.
I got to use it like one time and it blew.
Control Weather.
Yeah, exactly. Also, these are druid spells is the problem.
I like Tsunami. Did you know you don't have to be on the water to use Tsunami?
I did know that, and I still struggled to find a use for it. I had options.
All right, any other spells here that you really like? I thought immovable object is probably very breakable. You make an object immovable for an hour. Great. I'm about to get swallowed every single time that I can.
Right. I will rip through you on the inside, sir. I like Fortune's Favor.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Which is like, it's for one, it takes a minute, so it's limited in what you can do. But for an hour, it lets you like spend the spell to reroll the d20.
Yeah, I like what it does. What I didn't like is that it costs 100 gold pearl that is consumed.
Oh, yeah, that's a fair point.
But if you upcast it, it's still 100 gold pearl, right?
Yeah.
And it can affect more people. So then it becomes much more cost effective.
It's, again, it's limited, right? Because it's an hour. And like you said, it does have a material cost that could be important to you in your game. But I like the ability. I like the idea of giving you like that reroll chance. Like, because that's one of those things where, is it more powerful? Yeah, sure. But like, ultimately, D&D is more fun when everybody succeeds on their stuff, mm-hmm. and then gets hit hard by enemies that are also succeeding. Like, the null state of I rolled and I missed just sucks.
This is basically a way for you to pay in-game gold to give everybody inspiration.
Yeah, exactly. That's basically what it is. And, you know, there's also, because it doesn't use concentration, I don't think there's a limit to how many times you can do this.
Oh, actually, yeah, it is a good prep spell.
Yeah, so if, you know, like, I don't know. It's one of those things where it's just like, cool, this spell costs us a little bit, but makes D&D more fun. I'm all for that.
One spell that does worry me a little bit here is the 9th level spell Time Ravage, which is cool. It's a constitution saving throw, and if you fail, you take a decent amount of damage. But then it ages the person to 30 days from when they would die of old age. So if you're an elf, you're now like 1100 years old. If you're an orc, you're now like 65, right? And then you also get disadvantage on attacks, saving throws, and ability checks because you are about to topple over from old age. Now, here's the thing that concerns me a little bit. If players use this on an enemy, who cares? They were going to die anyway, right? Like, the whole point is that we defeat this enemy. Mm-hmm. But if an enemy uses it on a PC, now they are 30 days from dying of old age. Now, the spell says it can only be fixed by wish or a 9th level greater restoration. The problem is, if then you can't fix it in 30 days, one, your character sucks for 30 days in-game, and that's boring and awful. And then if you die, many of the spells that bring you back to life that people depend on don't work because you died of old age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's one of those spells that is a game changer, right? Like, it's one of those spells that almost works better narratively,
mm-hmm.
because now you have to scheme to solve for it.
Right.
It's one of those things where if you telegraph it, so the party knows it's coming, like, they do some preparation. And I think it's actually really cool to like have a spell that doesn't just save or suck and like unsolvably, like 9th level greater restoration or wish, there's a good chance you have one of those in your party if you're facing a 9th level caster, right? 9th level greater restoration, you might be close. You might need to like do some narrative things to solve that, but it's better than just dying, right? Like, it's better than power word kill.
No, I think it's worse than power word kill, because if you die from power word kill and we survive, then we're just going to take you to a cleric who can cast a 5th level raise dead and you'll be back in the game. But this, you are screwed unless we can figure out how to do a quest. And like, I like the idea. You're right. I like the idea that you can like put this into the story and like make it part of a quest. My worry, though, is if you are a GM who's looking at the CR12 Archmage who has access to 9th level spells and is like, hey, Time Stop sucks, I'm just going to swap out a spell. How about Time Ravage? That's kind of the same thing, and that's cool. Let me try this out. And mm-hmm. then they just blast someone with it. You have probably really screwed up your story.
That's fair. 9th level spells come in a lot earlier for enemies than they do for players. Don't disagree. I think of this from a narrative perspective and think of like the possibilities of what this could do, while also being a relatively effective spell in your like combat as well, right? Even if you just get the damage off and they succeed on the save, like, it doesn't feel like you've wasted your 9th level slot in the way that like power word kill does.
Oh, I mean, like, if you can age a BBEG and now they have disadvantage on everything, I mean, who cares that they're old? They were, you're here to kill them anyway, but this is a huge encounter long debuff. So it is a good spell.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I think its narrative interest to me outweighs its complication, with that caveat that you should not use this at low levels.
Yeah, like, I mean, I will throw that caveat on here. Like, GMs, just be careful when you use it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah, I don't know. I'm okay if we're level 15 or 16, right? And we ostensibly have access to these kinds of resources and maybe have to pay a price to get to them. Mm. I think that's interesting.
Yeah. So I would say, as a whole, these spells, I don't think it's going to change and certainly won't break a game if Wizards have access to these spells with no restrictions. Also, nobody is going to be basically crying because they can't get these spells because they decided 3 years ago that they want to be an Evoker or a Necromancer.
I mean, Temporal Shunt is an even worse counterspell, right? Like, in terms of, like, stopping fun. Like, you know, when you get into those, like, ooh, boy, like, granted, this one is a wisdom save versus, you know, like, just automatically happening by upcasting and things like that. But, like, so it is on a reaction when a creature that you can see makes an attack roll or starts to cast the spell, right? That you force a wisdom save and you throw them forward one round in time, they waste the spell or attack. That is, oh boy. Like, how do you account for that? You know, like, it gets into this chain of reaction spells and just like the fun denying control spells that can be problematic if everybody is focused on them. And that becomes your like MO as a gaming group in D&D.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like, this just ups the arms race a little bit more. Like, everyone mm-hmm. sort of at the table needs to be like, hey, we're not going to get into a counterspell war because that's just not fun.
Right.
But, like, I'm not really sure why this spell exists. Like, from a player perspective, I would rather just have counterspell, which is lower level and can do more. From an enemy perspective, if I use this on a player, they disappear and don't reappear until the start of their next turn, which means I now have a player who does not need to pay attention to the table at all for probably 15 minutes, and I'm going to lose them.
Yeah, I mean, that's like the blink spell. People, like, you know, like, players voluntarily opt for that too.
But at least they picked it, right? But me, this is sure. Just this is just me being like, you disappear. Like,
right.
Go to the bathroom. Go fix yeah. some food.
All right, we've beat this to death. fundamentally, this one is, do you like Counterspell or not? If so, here's another one. If not, probably don't like this one.
All right, next up we get the Heroic Chronicle, which is billed as a way to like tie characters into the main storyline, but this feels a lot to me like a different version of random character generation and random backstory generation that we got in was it Xanathar's Guide?
It was Xanathar's Guide.
Mm-hmm. It is basically random backstory generation. You roll dice to figure out your homeland and like what the settlement was in that homeland. You can roll to see what your actual like background that you choose for your character will be. It does say you should go into this not necessarily knowing what race or what class or where you want to be from. Like, these things should all still be up in the air.
Yeah, it's not quite life path by any stretch, but I'm cool with it. I could see myself, especially if I'm new to the setting, just creating my character that way.
I mean, I think, you know, Jim freaked out that there was an entire page of rolling your favorite foods. He was extremely happy about that. I do like that you can roll, you know, allies and rivals and your relationships, and then you can roll on a table to find out what their stat block is. Like, what entry in the monster manual is this person? And then the thing that actually, I've heard some people talk about like being worried about power creep. The only thing that actually adds power here is the one table on fateful moments, which is like important turning events in your life. And those can give you something like an armor or skill or weapon proficiency or maybe a feat, or one of them, like you get lycanthropy.
Right.
These almost all just give extra stuff to your character and make them stronger. But like, if you're using this in a campaign, then everybody should be using this in some way. Like, everybody should be rolling on this table to get something for free.
In a way, this is like the innovation in this book that I really love. And I get the power creep thing. I agree. It needs to be pretty much everybody gets it, which undermines a little bit on the table rolling. But like, I think this is actually kind of the cool part of this, where it does give you that like defining moment, that crystallizes your backstory. So I like this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's cool. And then, you know, you can roll on like your mysterious secret or what the prophecy is about you. Those don't actually have any mechanical benefits or even effects. They're just potential things that you can tie into your backstory or the campaign going forward.
Yep. Okay. There are two new backgrounds as well. There is the Grinner, who is the representative of the Golden Grin, which is something from the Tal Dorei setting. Basically, they're like a network of bards and minstrels that work as, I don't know, basic a spy network, right?
Like, so Harpers.
Okay, yeah. Sure, Harpers.
And then the ability is you can sing in a large city and you'll attract an ally who can give you shelter. Or you might attract an enemy, it says. So, you know, your background ability also might screw you, but I guess it also might just be an adventure hook.
Right.
And then there is Volstrucker Agent. You are one of the arcane assassins who works for the Cerberus Assembly. There's a table for your tragic backstory. What terrible thing happened to you to make you an assassin?
Mm-hmm.
And then the feature, you can contact the Assassin Network in a very cool way, I might add. You write a note in magic ink, you burn it in a fire, and it appears on the person it was addressed to.
I mean, memento style, I guess.
Yeah. Yes, it tattoos itself on their chest backwards.
I mean, until red. All right, then there are Adventures in Wildemount, which are four beginner adventures, each for levels 1 through 3.
Each of these are like 10 to 15 pages, so it's a significant chunk of the book. There's Tide of Retribution, where the party is trying to stop Sahagin attacks on the Menagerie Coast.
Yep, start with this one. Just do this one. Don't listen to any of the others.
Yeah. Why would you not stop the Sahagin? The shark people are terrible. Nobody likes them. So each of these adventures takes place in a different area of the continent. So depending on where you want to start out, you can, you know, pick a different one. So
right.
In Dangerous Designs, the party is trying to stop a freed war criminal somewhere in the Dwendalian Empire.
Spoiler, he's like a mad inventor who has this crazy like 40K orc power armor and looks very much like a mech boy or like a dreadnought cobbled together. Actually, this one is cool. This has my seal of approval.
In Frozen Sick, there's a deadly plague that is killing villagers in the Graying Wildlands.
And then in Unwelcome Spirits, a goblin warlock has been kidnapped from the village she protects in the Kryn Dynasty.
I like this one because, you know, you hear goblin warlock has been kidnapped and you're like, oh, good. But then you're like, oh, no, wait, she's the one protecting the village and keeping everyone safe on the back of this giant tortoise.
Right.
It is maybe a good intro to players who are used to maybe like traditional Forgotten Realms, like racial alignments. Wildemount subscribes to the Eberron philosophy, where race does not necessarily determine whether you are good or evil or lawful or chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
And then chapter 6, magic items from common all the way up to artifact.
Yeah. Any standouts in here for you?
I really like the Arcane Cannon, but that's probably because we are currently recapping the beginning of the Gates of Morning campaign, and I was like, hey, there's an Arcane Belief Stand, you gotta go fix that. That's exactly what this is. It's a large magic item, it is a weapon, it has multiple long-range options, like giant bolts. I think the Frost Bolt has a range of 1,200 feet. It's crazy. I mean, crazy in a good way. Like, mount this on your flying castle, right?
Right. I was happy to see that there is a very rare hammer in here. One of the things I've noticed at the top end is it's very difficult to get melee weapons that are not swords.
You're talking about Dusk Crusher, right?
Yep.
It is a Sunblade Warhammer in that it is just a rod, and then when you turn it on, it's not a lightsaber blade, it's a radiant energy Warhammer head, mm-hmm. which is so cool.
And it does a little extra damage to undead creatures, and then it also lets you cast the Sunbeam spell, which is actually more powerful than a Sunblade.
Oh yeah, because it's +2 just like a Sunblade, and yeah, Sunbeam is what, 6th level? It's a good spell.
It's a low save DC. I mean, but you know, you don't get the benefit of like the finesse with a longsword. That's the whole point of Sunbeam.
Oh, because it's a rogue weapon.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a common magic item called a breathing bubble, which gives you 1 hour of air per day. So that's nice that you can start doing undersea adventures with basically first level parties. The butcher's bib gives you, once per turn, you can just re-roll your damage dice, and then you've got a permanent 19 to 20 crit range with slashing damage.
Saves you that dip into champion, huh?
Yeah. 3 levels is a lot.
We get the legendary wondrous item, Luxon Beacon, which, of course, graces the cover.
Yeah, it's got secrets that will probably be revealed as part of the campaign. I love the Nightfall Pearl. It's a legendary item. All it does is it makes it nighttime within a 10-mile radius. I love that. It just, why is this legendary? Oh, because it does a really cool, amazing thing that nothing else can do. Why do I need this? Well, I mean, we wanted to attack at night. Why don't I just make it night?
Yeah, or it's great for an enemy to like herald their arrival, right? They're known for always attacking at night. How do they do that? Well, they make it night.
Yeah, and it lasts for 24 hours of nighttime. Also, I mean, like a shadow monk. Hey, I work better in the dark.
Or a vampire, like, yeah. A vampire lord. Like, I go where I want. It's the land of always night.
And then there are vestiges of divergence. These are legendary items that have different tiers of abilities. This is basically the return of items of legacy.
Mm-hmm.
So every one of these, like the individual items don't actually matter. Like it's the mechanics of awakening these abilities that are probably the most interesting. They all have dormant abilities, like just standard abilities that you have as soon as you find them. And then as your character either gains levels or some sort of important story event happens, you get abilities tied to its awakened state. And then eventually it gets an exalted state where you have all of the like legendary abilities of this item.
So I think this is the coolest part of this book, personally. I like that they have these like sort of 3 states. If I have a gripe, it's that the whole thing is legendary always. Mm-hmm. And like, I get that legendary is a function, right? And like, that's why it's so high level, is because they're probably like unique or near unique in the universe. Great. But what I need as a DM is actually the relative power level of its given states so that I know when to give it to players and when to upgrade it for players.
Right. Yeah.
And without that, it's very difficult to judge. Like the very first one, Dannoth's Visor, which is one of the only ways in the game to get the ability to see in magical darkness, right? That's its dormant state. It gives you 60 feet of dark vision in magical darkness. And like, you know, a benefit to investigation and perception checks. Awesome. How powerful is that to a character?
Right.
Because that's what I want to know. When I give it in its dormant state, I control when it awakens. So I don't really care that the item itself is legendary. What I care is, when do I give it out?
Yeah. And like, you and I can sit here and go, okay, so Goggles of Night lets you see in regular darkness, but not magical, and those are uncommon, so this has to be at least rare. It's probably not a very rare, so I would call the dormant state rare. But you shouldn't have to have an encyclopedic knowledge of every other 5e item to compare it to. Yeah, I totally agree here.
But I do like them. A lot of them are very cool. I would check those out. Just getting those in the game, kind of worth having this book.
Yeah. It does say that normally you're going to find a dormant item sometime before level 9, probably. You will probably awaken it sometime between levels 9 and 15, and you will probably awaken the exalted level sometime between 16 and 20.
Yep.
And then we get the Arms of the Betrayer, which are evil artifact weapons.
Uh-huh. Seems like all artifacts are evil at this point. There's like 4 good ones. So then we have the bestiary, which includes 23 new creatures, CR 1 to 17.
I like this bestiary. With a few standouts here, the CR 1 creatures, several of them anyway, are pretty intense. There's the Corspawn Crawler, CR 1, and it gets 4 attacks.
Yikes.
They don't do a ton of damage. That doesn't matter.
They don't do a ton of damage until they crit, and right. In which case, like, now you're doubling.
Right, now you're just paste.
Right.
The other CR1 that was interesting is the Husk Zombie. It's a normal zombie, except that any humanoid killed by it rises as a Husk Zombie the next round.
Yeah, put some innocence on the screen and see how out of hand this encounter gets.
Oh, yeah.
NPCs, you turn into husks.
What, you don't want to save the people in the tavern? Okay, great. You're fighting 40 of these things.
So I think the two notable things in here, the high CR 17 is the frost worm. Basically, that's a purple worm with an at-will area stun. And then, yeah. Of course, the thing we're all here for is the CR 5 blood hunter.
You mean here to kill them?
Here for some reason or another. You'll note the art, it has him one hand wielding a greatsword.
That is on fire. Hexblade before Hexblade.
The Bloodhunter is a pretty normal CR5. It gets to cast Hex innately, and then it also has a Blood Frenzy ability, which lets it have advantage on melee attacks for any creature that doesn't have all its hit points.
Yeah, I'd rather face one of these than a regular gladiator from the Monster Manual. Because, you know, they trade HP for power, so they only have 65 hit points.
And then one weird thing we noticed as we were trying to pull this together, there seem to be a lot more creatures that are associated with Wildemount in D&D Beyond, including like some legendary characters like Kareth Zarethzerus, who's a CR 23 silver dragon.
Those have stat blocks too?
They have stat blocks. They have page references to the book. But they're all pages in the Gazetteer, so they're like name checked on that page, but they don't have a stat block except in D&D Beyond.
Okay.
I don't know what the story is behind that. If that's just like extra online content, if that's free content, I'm not clear. But there are some more things available through D&D Beyond associated with Wildemount.
Yeah, maybe it's just they're called out in the Gazetteer as this is an adult silver dragon, and so they've also just put a named adult silver dragon in D&D Beyond.
Yeah, I would have to check.
Yeah. Huh.
And I won't do that.
Oh, can you do me a favor? You have it open right now, right?
I do.
Does it have an audio file next to the name? Like one of those little play things?
The name of Kareth Zethrus?
Yeah.
Don't see it.
Interesting. Okay. I just remember that Matthew Mercer and Mercer Ray from Critical Role did probably about half or maybe more than half of the pronunciations for monsters in D&D Beyond. So I was wondering if they also did it for these new creatures.
Mm. Yeah, I don't think there's anything else in here that like has such a strange name it needs a pronunciation. So, but I don't know. Maybe they'll get to it.
All right, then there's a glossary. I love that there's a glossary.
Yeah, bringing it back old school.
And then, maybe my favorite part of any book, the index. A real index.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've seen an index in a D&D book, huh?
Yeah, Eberron didn't have an index, and that sucked.
Right. Okay, so as always, we talk about the art. We've talked a little bit about some of the style that we've seen. I think my main takeaway is that there is, as usual, not a real unified art style here. Mm-hmm. You've got some like painted canvases that look like, you know, the sort of fantasy art you might find anywhere. And then you have the very like what I would call like kind of the Critical Role fan art style of like flat textures, but like lots of line detail.
Yeah. There's some very good art, there's some middling art, and there's a fair amount of recycled art. A lot of the races that are reprinted just use old art, but there is definitely some new art along those lines. And then this book continues the tradition of actually really like pretty nice magic item art that is all done in a pretty simple unified style, but it is nice to know what it is that you're discovering and to be able to actually see it.
I will say that does not apply to the maps. Like, I actually really like the map style a lot. Both like when they have their city maps as well as just like the overall continent map. Like, I think that stuff, those zoom ins look really great. They're like, there's enough proper nouns on there to give you inspiration if you wanted to use it for something else, but it's not like so dense that you can't find anything.
Yeah. And there are also a fair number of like battle maps that are printed on a grid, which look pretty nice. Plus, you also get the big tear out, fold out map of the entire continent, which you know, is the typical 5e style map. It's pretty sturdy paper,
right? And then the other thing, not technically an art, but I guess language is an art. What I really like about this book is that it doesn't have a bunch of like those awful 80s and 90s style like unpronounceable proper nouns that you can't possibly hold in your head. It uses a few proper nouns, but in a lot of ways, it's just taking words and combining them into compound words that are somewhat representative of what they are.
Right. Or small changes. Dracon blood, right? It feels a lot like Wild Mount, or maybe the entire world of Exandria is basically what Forgotten Realms would be were it made now rather than in the 70s and 80s.
Or like, were it made to be said out loud instead of read in a novel?
Right. Were it made by someone who is presenting material for an audience rather than beginning with six people around a table?
Right. All right. So let's wrap this up. As always, is this a buy for you, Yushin?
Interesting. For me, as someone who doesn't watch Critical Role, this basically feels like a Forgotten Realms reskin that, to be fair, is, I think, done better than most Forgotten Realms. Like, the world really feels like it holds together. Wild Mount feels like a place where the nations and the relationships between those nations actually make sense. But that said, like, it's just a generic high fantasy setting that I could make up myself, or I could get a number of other places. And in terms of the crunch material, the subraces and the races, there's nothing in here that would make me say that, ooh, I need to run out and get it, nor is there anything where, like, I would be jealous if someone else had it and I didn't. So for me, I would not buy this.
I think I have a kinder reading on the rules portion of the book than you do. Like, I kind of like some of the stuff that's in here. But I do agree with you in terms of, like, if you're not very excited about this setting, I think it's a little difficult to justify buying the whole book. And fortunately, or perhaps unfortunately for sales, I don't know how that's going to shake out. Like, I think a lot of the audience already knows what they're getting from this book, and they're seeing the expansion of things that they've heard about. So, you know, I think if you're a Critical Role fan, like, this is going to give you the stuff you want. If you're not, you got to kind of think about it a little more individually. I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence of the buy or don't buy.
Yeah, I'd say if you're a Critical Role fan, then think about if you are going to use this. Is your campaign set in Tal Darai? If it is, then maybe go look at the Green Ronin book. If you're going to play in Wildmount, then this is a no-brainer. Definitely pick this up. But also, there are a lot of people out there who listen to Critical Role who don't necessarily play in the setting.
Right.
If that appeals to you, then I would say definitely get this book, because there's also a lot of information in here that you can extrapolate to a game set anywhere on Exandria. Like, when I say this is not a book for me, that's not really a reflection of the quality of the book. It has a, well, I was going to say it has a niche audience, but I think I might be wrong on that. Maybe non-Critical Role D&D is the niche audience these days. I'm pretty sure when this was first announced in, what, January, it immediately shot to the top of the New York Times bestseller list.
Yeah, because of the pre-order.
Right. So I have a feeling this is going to be the most popular 5e book of all time, although every new 5e book is the most popular 5e book of all time.
Right. Of the kind of alternative D&D settings that have been published, I would put this ahead of Guildmaster's Guide to Ravnica or Acquisitions Inc.
I would too, although Ravnica had a lot more crunch that can be used across different campaign settings.
True. But I would still rather have this book.
Yeah, and it introduces a lot of things that I love, the Heroic Chronicle and the...
Just the magic items to me.
The Vestiges better. Of Divergence that level up with you. Mm-hmm.
All right, so I guess a buy or do not buy, both with reservations. All right, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
Well, we do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sends Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Total Party Thrill.
And check out the conversation on Discord. So before we wrap up, we want to take a moment and thank our Patreon supporters.
Yeah, your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every single week. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out our rewards at patreon.com/TotalPartyThrill.
And one of those rewards coming right down the pike is our Forgotten Realms campaign setting overview.
Yep, we are finally getting to it in our long-running series on campaign settings that you might want to play in. We skipped the most obvious one.
Uh-huh. Well, I believe we paywalled the most obvious one.
You had to convince us with money. And you have.
Yeah, it's coming next week.
I don't know what we're going to do, but we will do something.
You can also support the show by leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes, or Apple Podcasts, as it's now called. It's the best way to support us and help other people find us. If you do, we will read it on the air. So, what do we have planned for next week's episode, Ishan?
We are frantically figuring out what to say in our episode on the Forgotten Realms campaign setting.
Well, that's it for episode 243 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.
Leave behind the safety of the Humblewood and travel down the Tangrip coast to the Bay of Palouche, home to both the Kingdom of Den and the Serpent Domain. But neither hold the true power of the Bay, for that lies in the sea itself and the pirate lords that call her tides their own. The dread pirate Captain Bluebeak, Tiberius Fang, Kin the Bladeless, and Gabrielle LaFleur, the self-proclaimed pirate queen. Each one vying for power over the very tides themselves. But do any of them really have what it takes to hold up the legacy of the briny bulldog? Tune in each week to find out if our little crew has what it takes to stand up to the pirates of the blood-soaked waters of the Bay of Palouche. Dark Fortunes is available every Monday. Just search Dark Fortunes on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and set sail for high seas adventure.